Have you ever wondered why seemingly obvious policy solutions often fail to materialize? Why, despite mountains of evidence and expert recommendations, our governments frequently implement policies that appear contradictory or counterproductive? Deborah Stone's Policy Paradox has become the essential guidebook for understanding these perplexing questions. Since its publication, this work has achieved cult status among political science students and policy practitioners alike, with former President Barack Obama reportedly keeping it on his reference shelf during his time in the White House. The book's enduring popularity stems from its revolutionary premise. Policy isn't a technical puzzle to be solved through rational analysis, but a deeply human struggle over values, meanings, and relationships. Stone invites us to see policy not as a science, but as an art form, where ambiguity isn't a bug, but a feature, where metaphors matter as much as metrics, and where the most powerful policy analysis comes from understanding the stories we tell ourselves about who we are as a community. Imagine two radically different worlds. In one, individuals operate as autonomous decision makers, calculating self-interest through rational choices. In the other, people exist in webs of relationships, driven by both self-interest and altruism, influenced by others, and working together in complex patterns of cooperation and conflict. The first world, the market model, has dominated policy thinking for decades. The second world, what Stone calls the polis, is where policy actually happens. The market model, with its Robinson Crusoe metaphor of isolated individuals trading coconuts, fundamentally misunderstands political life. In reality, communities form the foundation of politics. Membership, who belongs and who doesn't, becomes a primary political issue, manifesting in citizenship policies and immigration laws. Consider Arizona's controversial 2010 legislation targeting undocumented immigrants or European integration requirements for newcomers. These aren't technical questions, but fundamental struggles over community boundaries. The polis acknowledges altruism as a powerful human motive that the rationality paradigm makes nearly invisible. While market theorists dismiss charitable acts as disguised self-interest because they provide psychological satisfaction, humans regularly act to benefit others through childcare, volunteering, and helping colleagues. Some even subvert unjust rules when they believe a higher moral duty exists, creating what sociologists call the moral underground, like managers who bend rules to help struggling low-wage workers. In the polis, influence bridges the gap between self-interest and public interest. Our desires aren't spontaneously generated, but shaped by education, persuasion, and socialization. Our choices depend on what others do and what we expect them to do, creating collective behaviors like bandwagon effects in elections and economic panics. The fuzzy line between influence and coercion represents a fundamental difference between liberal and conservative perspectives. Liberals see poverty as coercive, while conservatives restrict coercion to physical force. Cooperation rivals competition in importance within the polis. Politics involves seeking allies and cooperating with them to compete against opponents. Every conflict unites some people as it divides others. Even prison guards with apparent control must bargain with inmates for cooperation, and military counterinsurgency strategies rely on winning civilian cooperation through providing basic services and showing respect. Unlike the market's perfect information, political information is ambiguous, incomplete, and strategically manipulated. What we believe depends on sources, presentation, language, context, and timing. Information access is unequal due to costs, education requirements, and deliberate secrecy, making information control a powerful political tool. Most importantly, political resources follow laws of passion rather than material scarcity. They often expand through use rather than diminish. Influence channels grow stronger with use, collaboration builds commitment, and authority strengthens through precedent. Things in politics can simultaneously hold multiple, even contradictory meanings. Nominal fines for white-collar crime both condemn and condone, while medical spending growth represents both financial burden and life-saving progress.
When we argue about distributions, whether of goods, wealth, health, or opportunity, all sides seek equality, but differ in how they envision a fair distribution. The paradox is that equality often means inequality, and equal treatment often means unequal treatment. The same distribution may look equal or unequal depending on where you focus. Imagine distributing a chocolate cake. Simple, equal slices seem fair, but what if some people are hungrier than others? What if some contributed more to buying ingredients? What if some have dietary restrictions? Each competing vision of equality would result in unequal slices, but equality of something else. Membership defines who counts as entitled to equal treatment. The American political system was designed to reconcile severe conflicts over membership, as seen in the Constitution's paradoxical treatment of slaves as both human beings and property. Modern examples include the Cherokee Nation's 2007 decision to exclude people of mixed Cherokee Black heritage from tribal citizenship, and varying state policies on felons' voting rights. Merit, reward for individual accomplishment, becomes problematic when we try to identify and quantify it. Academic aptitude testing illustrates these challenges, with critics arguing that standardized tests contain cultural biases, favor wealthy students who can afford test preparation, and fail to measure important qualities like leadership potential. Despite these complexities, merit remains the primary justification for income inequality in the U.S., where the top 1% receives over 1/5 of total national income. Need redefines what's being distributed, expanding it as part of a larger whole. In student financial aid, schools must decide whether to distribute based solely on academic merit or consider financial need. Similarly, welfare and tax policies must define assets and recognize that different required expenses affect disposable income, leading to deductions for dependents and medical costs. Global inequality is vast and growing. The 500 richest people have more income than the poorest 416 million. These inequalities damage communities, where income gaps are large, trust diminishes, violence increases, discrimination worsens, and civic participation declines. Democracy's ideal of one person, one vote is meant to counterbalance property power with voice power, but income inequality fundamentally undermines this democratic ideal when wealthy candidates self-finance campaigns, elected officials respond primarily to wealthy constituents, and corporations maintain full-time lobbying staffs earning access through campaign contributions. Efficiency isn't a goal itself, but a comparative criterion for judging policy alternatives, getting the most output for the least input. Though everyone favors efficiency in principle, conflicts arise over three questions: who receives benefits and bears burdens, how should we measure costs and benefits, and which organizational mode yields the most efficient results. Consider a public library. Different stakeholders might prioritize book collections, digital resources, employment opportunities, or accessibility. Each efficiency calculation requires political judgments about which objectives matter, whose interests count, how to value inputs that are simultaneously outputs, which secondary effects to include, and how to weigh opportunity costs. Markets are often presented as inherently efficient, but this assumption rests on several idealized conditions that rarely exist in reality. Market efficiency requires participants to have complete, accurate information about alternatives, yet in reality, businesses strategically withhold information as competitive strategy. Manufacturers exaggerate claims, pharmaceutical companies conceal unfavorable studies, and financial companies hide negative contract features in fine print. Market theory assumes voluntary exchanges, but poverty and inequality undermine choice. Even mainstream economic relationships involve power imbalances that compromise voluntarism. Landlords and tenants, insurers and policyholders, employers and employees. When the stronger party sets terms or terminates relationships, the weaker side often has little meaningful choice. Market exchanges often affect people who aren't party to them. These effects are called externalities. Initially considered limited exceptions to market efficiency, like pollution, we now recognize externalities as pervasive,
Nearly all production and consumption creates environmental impacts, and economic decisions like outsourcing production create ripple effects far beyond the immediate transaction. Free markets struggle to provide public goods because individuals rationally choose to free ride rather than contribute voluntarily. Markets can't produce community, the paramount public good, because they're inherently competitive and divisive, rewarding self-interest and discouraging collaboration. Paradoxically, markets themselves are public goods, requiring government-created trust systems to function. Without contract enforcement and regulations, people would only trade simple goods with strangers. The equality-efficiency trade-off is not an immutable natural law, but a political choice. Different administrations distribute national wealth differently. Democratic administrations tend to create more equal income distribution across economic classes, while Republican ones increase inequality. Despite claims of a fundamental incompatibility, evidence shows Democratic administrations achieve lower unemployment, almost 30% lower, and higher GNP growth, over 40% higher, than Republican ones. Welfare represents government's responsibility to provide for human needs, not merely desires. While most agree society should help those in dire circumstances, defining need becomes a political contest. The simplest definition, what's necessary for physical survival, proves inadequate in practice. A purely objective approach, like a hypothetical, nutritionally optimal meal in a pill, fails to address food's cultural significance, quality dimensions, social functions, and relative nature. People have symbolic needs beyond material ones, relational needs beyond individual ones, and their sense of well-being depends partly on comparison with others in their community. Material things carry symbolic meanings, often more important than their physical value. Food signifies membership, status, and spiritual worth. Sharing meals indicates friendship and belonging. Immigrants adopt American foods to feel included. Religious practices like Ramadan fasting demonstrate how spiritual needs may temporarily supersede physical ones. Some needs matter not for their inherent satisfaction, but for enabling other capabilities. Money represents the primary instrumental need in capitalist societies, leading to income-based welfare measures like poverty lines. However, economist Amartya Sen argues income inadequately measures welfare because true well-being depends on capabilities, the means to pursue chosen ends, including nutrition, healthcare, education, and political rights. Welfare depends not just on current resources, but on feelings of security about the future. Job loss devastates happiness, second only to losing a partner. But even job insecurity causes significant distress. In the U.S., income volatility has tripled since 1970, with the chance of losing half one's income rising from 7% to 20%. Though only 20% of American children live in poverty at any moment, half experience poverty before turning 18. Humans require relationships that provide friendship, love, dignity, respect, and community belonging, needs that can't be claimed as individual entitlements. After disasters like the Buffalo Creek flood, victims mourn lost community connections more than possessions. Workers often value workplace dignity above pay. The need to give and care for others proves equally powerful. Ghetto residents receiving windfalls typically give money away to help others rather than improve their own material welfare. Welfare definitions can use absolute standards, fixed income thresholds, or relative standards, like Dutch disability insurance requiring inability to earn the community's average wage. Though 13% of Americans live below the poverty line, most have air conditioning and cars, either evidence of irresponsibility or recognition that people strive to meet prevailing standards. Research confirms relative needs' importance. People assess well-being by comparing themselves to others, with those in the top income quartile consistently reporting greater happiness regardless of national wealth. Liberty represents a mythic ideal whose meanings emerge through debates and struggles rather than abstract philosophical theories. Abraham Lincoln observed that we all declare for liberty but mean different things by it.
To Northerners, freedom meant enjoying the product of one's labor, while to white Southerners, it meant power over others. The linguistic roots of liberty and freedom reveal different emphases. Liberty, from Latin libertas, meaning unbounded, unrestricted, or released from restraint, connoting independence and separateness, while freedom comes from Indo-European fria, meaning beloved, suggesting relationships rather than independence. Isaiah Berlin's famous essay presents two concepts: negative liberty, freedom from interference, and positive liberty, ability to be self-directed and realize one's goals. These concepts divide American politics. Conservatives generally emphasize negative liberty and the freedom to use resources without interference, while liberals lean toward positive liberty, viewing it as requiring basic resources like education, healthcare, and income to enable meaningful choice. While John Stuart Mill acknowledged that there are positive acts for the benefit of others that people may be compelled to perform, he quickly abandoned this topic. In reality, societies require numerous obligations: honoring contracts, paying taxes, surrendering land for public projects through eminent domain, educating children, and obeying laws even when violations harm no one directly. These restrictions protect social order itself. Mill's position on paternalism was simple: government should never interfere with an individual's liberty for their own good. Yet he made an exception for preventing people from enslaving themselves, since that would permanently eliminate liberty. This raises the question of whether other situations warrant restricting freedom to preserve future choices. Health and safety regulations often follow this logic, protecting people from choices that might impair future freedom. Cultural diversity creates challenging questions about liberty for minorities. Should groups have rights as groups? How should governments help minorities maintain their cultures? Muslim women's veils have sparked fierce debates, with France banning headscarves in schools, 2004, and full face veils in public places, 2011. French officials claim veils oppress women, while opponents argue veils express religious beliefs without harming anyone. Some women say veils enhance their liberty by shielding them from male attention and consumer culture pressures. The liberty-equality trade-off argument claims that to maintain equality, government must restrict the advantaged, thus limiting their liberty. This view assumes a negative concept of liberty and adopts the perspective of the advantaged. However, from a positive liberty concept and the disadvantaged viewpoint, this trade-off isn't inevitable. A society that equalizes resources like wealth, health, education, and political rights also equalizes citizens' freedom to choose their life plans, making liberty and equality complementary rather than contradictory.
Security once suggested wars, invasions, and crime, but since 9/11, it evokes terrorism and surveillance. Yet ordinary people experience terror in everyday situations, as illustrated by Alba, a single mother worried about her children while working late. Security takes many forms. Economic security means reliable income. Food security involves adequate nutrition and safe food. Cybersecurity protects computers and financial identities. Personal security means protection from crime and abuse. Safety involves protection from accidents, and environmental security preserves natural resources from human destruction. Security is ultimately a feeling, not just objective circumstances. While risk analysts reduce dangers to measurable outcomes and probabilities, ordinary people imagine how events might affect them personally. Insecurity involves dread, anxiety, and powerlessness that can cause both psychic pain and physiological harm. The expected value formula in risk analysis, probability times magnitude, doesn't capture human experience, as it mathematically reduces catastrophic but unlikely events to small numbers, while human imagination easily envisions the catastrophe but struggles to process probability. Political leaders create security through prevention, stopping threats, mitigation, reducing harm when bad things happen, and reassurance, calming fears. Reassurance may be most crucial, as it addresses worry directly and can succeed even when prevention fails. Leaders face a paradox: they must promise absolute safety while preparing for disasters.
To manage this dilemma, they often use absolutist language, declare war on threats, and act decisively even with minimal evidence. Security measures often function as double-edged swords that can undermine the very security they aim to create. Risk assessment itself can generate insecurity through the availability heuristic. Simply publicizing risks makes people overestimate dangers. Surveillance, like airport screening, may reassure some citizens but alienates others, particularly foreigners who feel stigmatized. Border controls, like walls and gated communities, provide physical protection but foster fortress mentalities, reinforcing prejudice. Prisons reduce crime through incapacitation but can increase long-term insecurity by making rehabilitation difficult and destroying family structures. Weapons, like guns, simultaneously represent security to some, self-defense tools, while threatening security to others, instruments of crime. Temporary suspensions of civil rights have imperceptibly transformed into permanent governance structures. Legislative bodies have lost power to executives, and in post-9/11 America, the same White House that exercised unchecked powers also decided they were necessary. An alternative view holds that the rule of law itself secures democracy's future and citizens' security. When government wields law as a weapon against its own citizens, invading privacy, searching without cause, detaining without charges, denying civil liberties, or even kidnapping and torturing, it undermines the essence of democracy and renders citizens profoundly insecure.
Symbols tell narrative stories with beginnings, middles, and ends, featuring heroes, villains, and transformations. These stories provide explanations of how the world works, often operating below conscious awareness while maintaining a powerful grip on our imaginations. Two prevalent story patterns in policy politics are stories of change, decline or rising, and stories of power, helplessness or control. Stories of change in policy debates include decline narratives, stymied progress narratives, and stories of rising. In terrorism debates, some argue that security measures have prevented attacks, while others claim these same measures undermine progress against terrorism. Health insurance debates feature competing stymied progress stories. Opponents fear reform will destroy an excellent system, while supporters argue that rising costs will destroy it without reform. Stories of power in policy debates revolve around the tension between helplessness and control. These narratives transform seemingly random or natural phenomena into situations amenable to human intervention. Keynes revolutionized economics by arguing governments could manage economic fluctuations. Public health agencies reframed heart disease and cancer as consequences of personal behavior rather than random afflictions. Environmental scientists linked human activity to climate change. Synecdoche, representing a whole by one of its parts, pervades policy discourse when typical cases define entire problems and frame responses. The welfare queen dominated 1990s welfare reform debates despite representing only one-fifth of recipients. Horror stories function as synecdoche when politicians use extreme cases to justify policy changes, like the ticking time bomb terrorist justifying torture after 9/11, or opponents of health reform transforming end-of-life counseling into death panels. Metaphors in policy analysis subtly conveyed entire narratives and prescriptions for action. Natural metaphors, like Malthus's population theory, constitute what Hirschman calls futility theses, stories suggesting human attempts at social improvement are doomed to fail. Mechanical metaphors, like checks and balances, imply stories about decline from balance to imbalance. Disease metaphors characterize unwanted behaviors as contagious and justify harsh interventions, like the broken windows theory of crime prevention. War metaphors sanction draconian measures and increased funding while bypassing cost considerations. Ambiguity is the most important feature of symbols in politics. A symbol can simultaneously hold multiple meanings, mean different things to different people, and change meaning across contexts. Ambiguity enables collective action by synchronizing diverse motivations and values. It allows leaders to aggregate support from different constituencies for a single policy, as when a president unites factions by invoking American interests, a concept everyone supports despite differing interpretations.
The Rationality Project, the mission to rescue public policy from politics through rational, analytical methods, has dominated political science, public administration, law, and economics for generations. This approach emerged from a desire to make governance more scientific and less susceptible to the messiness of human behavior. Yet this approach contains its own paradox. While passionately devoted to improving governance, it dismisses politics as an obstacle rather than recognizing its creative potential. This dismissal overlooks how political discourse and debate have historically driven social progress and innovation. Stone's policy paradox constructs a policy analysis model that acknowledges political conflict's dark side while valuing politics as a creative process for social harmony. It challenges the Rationality Project's worship of objectivity, demonstrating how even seemingly neutral analytical tools carry inherent biases. For instance, cost-benefit analyses often struggle to quantify intangible values like cultural heritage or community well-being. The book argues that analytical categories themselves are defined through political struggle. Consider how definitions of poverty, disability, or environmental harm evolve through political discourse rather than purely scientific determination. Instead of the market-based model of society as disconnected individuals pursuing self-interest, Stone proposes a community model where people live in webs of relationships and dependencies. This framework recognizes how individuals simultaneously pursue personal interests while caring about others and fighting for public goods. For example, parents might advocate for better schools not just for their own children, but for the entire community. Or citizens might support environmental regulations that impose personal costs but protect shared resources. The policy designer's job is to understand these game rules well enough to think strategically about standard moves and counter moves. Every policy idea draws boundaries that define who is included or excluded, whether through eligibility criteria, geographic limits, or temporal restrictions. These boundaries are strategically designed to forge some alliances and break others. Consider how healthcare policies might define pre-existing conditions, or how environmental regulations determine which industries face stricter controls. The book aims to help readers transcend their job descriptions to reflect on core values, deliberate with others, and improve the world through more nuanced policy design. In the end, policy paradoxes represent boundary tensions, as each policy solution is essentially a mode of constructing and maintaining boundaries that confer advantages or disadvantages. While analysis is often presented as scientific and neutral, it always includes some things while excluding others, making it a species of argument with a point of view. For instance, unemployment statistics might count or discount certain categories of workers, shaping our understanding of economic health. Politics, as a process of argument and persuasion, unites people through common aspirations, even as interpretations divide them. This dynamic tension creates opportunities for innovation and compromise. Political argument may seem messy, but it forces us to interact, persuade, and look beyond ourselves for grounds for action, allowing us to fight our border wars with imagination and words rather than violence. This creative conflict helps societies navigate complex challenges and find solutions that balance competing interests. Through this lens, policy analysis becomes not just a technical exercise, but a vital part of democratic discourse and social evolution.